So there are words and messages that are life-changing. I do is a life-changing statement. Those words are meant to seal what you hope is a lifelong relationship with the person that you love the most. I'm pregnant are life-changing words because you are never the same once you become a parent and learn that the agony of children can lead to some of your proudest moments. I want a divorce is a life-changing message. The two people that are involved, the children that are involved, the family and friends that are involved, everybody's life changes, and somewhat without fail, without escape, and for the worst. I still remember when my parents got divorced. You know, I've forgotten most of my childhood, but that is something that has stuck with me. And I'm sure some of you could say the same thing. But it was a mistake that my parents made that I don't intend to repeat, so I guess you could say that I was one of the lucky ones that through the negative experience, I turned it into a positive for me and my family. You're hired or you're fired can either lead to the thrill of victory or the agony of defeat. You know, one message may lead you to buy a house, another one may lead you to sell one. We find the defendant guilty. That may lead you to either seeing life behind bars or facing the end of your life through the death penalty, or it may just give you a sense that justice was served. There are many more messages and words that can change the life of an individual, a family, a community, an entire nation. But every message that is ever given can only change a life in this life. But there's one message that's been given in all the history of the world that can change a life forever, for eternity. The one message that, if received and believed, brings a transformation both in this life and in the life to come. And it's the only message that has an earthly effect, but also an eternal effect. It's the only message that can take you from death to life, from darkness to light, from blindness to sight. It's the message known as the gospel. It's the best news that the world has ever heard, because the gospel is the only solution to the world's greatest problem. It's the only cure for the world's greatest disease. It's the only bridge that can cross the world's greatest gulf. It's the X factor that was the spark that ignited the fire of Christianity that has now spread across the world and lasted over 2,000 years. It's changed the lives of today over 2 billion people. Now, you would think that those people who believe this gospel and receive this gospel would want this gospel to achieve a worldwide hearing. You would think that a gospel-changed life would be as eager to share that gospel with anyone who would be willing to listen as eagerly as someone who has found the cure for cancer. And yet, every statistic that I've ever read, it says that the vast majority of people who believe in the gospel rarely, if ever, share the gospel. And rarely, if ever, lead anyone else to believe in the gospel. A recent survey from Lifeway Research says that 58% of churchgoers say that they feel comfortable sharing their faith. However, when those same people were asked, 78% of them said that they had not shared their faith with anyone in the last 6 months. And 59% of them said that they haven't invited anyone to church in that same time frame. It begs the question, why would we ever be ashamed of the gospel? That's the question that Paul, the author of Romans, whose life was personally and radically and eternally changed by the gospel, addressed in the single greatest statement anyone has ever made about the gospel. Listen to these words. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. Let's all just get honest. We've all been ashamed of the gospel at one point or another in our lives. In fact, we're living in a day in which we seem to be ashamed of the things that are right just as much as we're ashamed of the things that are wrong. We seem to be unashamed of the pornography that's on our screens. 68% of church-going men and over 50% of pastors view porn on a regular basis. That's incredible to me. Of young Christian adults, 18 to 24, 76% actively search for porn. I've heard stories of people going into public libraries and just sitting down in the computer section and looking up porn and watching it right there like it's totally normal. People are unashamed of the objectification of the opposite sex, unashamed of the perversity that goes on in our government. On the other hand, we seem to be ashamed to stand for sexual morality or moral purity or personal integrity. In the name of tolerance, we have pinned truth to the mat, and in doing so, compromise has shut the mouth of conviction. We live in a time where we would rather offend God and fear our culture than offend culture and fear God. I believe the 21st century, more than ever, there's one thing that we should never be ashamed of in private conversation or in public discourse or proclaiming it to the culture. From God's house to the courthouse, from the halls of the church to the halls of government. And that is that to bring salvation to everyone who believes. There are three things that the gospel always brings to the table in which we should never be ashamed. The first one is we should be unashamed of the message of the gospel. Paul begins by saying, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel." Now, we need to make sure that we understand what we're not ashamed of. Okay, so Dwight W. Moody said this. He's a famous evangelist. He said, "I do not think there is a word in the English language so little understood as the word gospel." What do we mean by the word gospel? It's actually the first reason we should never be ashamed because of the meaning of the word gospel. It literally is good news. The English word comes from the Middle English word, Godspell, which comes from two Old English words, good and spell, which means story. Godspell is the good story. It's a story of good news. Originally, it was used at a specific time for a specific reason at a specific place. The place would be like the village square, you know, and where the community would all gather together, and the time would be like maybe after a great battle had been fought and finished, and the reason was so that the town herald could come out and scream at the top of his lungs, you know, "Good news! We've won the battle! Victory is ours!" Why would anyone be ashamed of good news? Why would we hesitate or equivocate when it comes to sharing the good news? Which is really the best news anyone will ever hear. I mean, you can understand why someone might hesitate to share bad news, right? You know, I mean, no military officer wants to go and share the bad news that a son or a daughter has been killed in action. No police officer wants to share with a parent that a son or a daughter isn't coming home again. No doctor relishes telling the patient that the tumor is inoperable. The gospel is not about bad news. It's about good news. If the baby's healthy, the father isn't ashamed to pass out the cigars, right? You know, when the tumor is benign, the doctor isn't afraid to tell the patient, "Hey, you're going to live." If interest rates ever do go down again, you know, and the stock market is going up, then stockbrokers aren't going to be afraid to talk about the economy. Why would anyone be ashamed of the gospel? Well, if you go back 2,000 years ago, there are two words that might explain the tendency to be ashamed. And I think that's still true today. And those words are Christ and cross. Think about it. The gospel is all about a poor Jewish carpenter who was crucified as a common criminal. And Paul's going into Rome, the capital city of the most powerful nation on earth, the world's only superpower at the time. And Paul is going to talk to these intense Roman soldiers, you know, these military commanders, these powerful politicians, and even an emperor who, if you know anything about history at all, you know this guy was insane. It was Emperor Nero who would eventually begin sending Christians into the arenas to die gruesome deaths as entertainment. The same Nero who would light Christians on fire like candles so that it could light up his garden. And Paul is supposed to talk about a Jewish carpenter who neither had any political power or political position. And to add insult to injury, a crucified Jew at that. Now, in polite society, he didn't really talk about the cross and crucifixion. You want to talk to us about a lowly Jewish carpenter who died the most gruesome, humiliating death that you could imagine. And beyond that, you're going to try to tell me that this isn't just a story that somebody made up, that this is actually true. Listen, if Christ is who he said he was, and if on the cross he did what he said he did, then not only is he the crucified Son of God, but he is the only way to God, because he is God, like we talked about last week. our unchanging truth. It's part of Jesus is our magic. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And then from that day to this day, that is a message that much of the world doesn't want to hear. If you share that message, understand that you will be crucified to the world, and the world will be crucified to you. That's what Paul says in the book of Galatians. He says, I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The reason why Paul was not ashamed of the gospel message is because he was not ashamed of the gospel author. I think that we sometimes fail to understand that Paul, he didn't know Jesus before the crucifixion. He wasn't one of the disciples. But nonetheless, Paul was sold out to Jesus. He wrote many of the New Testament letters from prison. Paul understood what Jesus meant when he said, follow me. Paul gave up everything, and he even changed his name. And I was thinking about this. You know, we know that Paul was arrested, but what about the others? We know Peter and John also were. And there were many others. Let me share this passage with you. But before I do, let me kind of set the scene here. So Peter and John are proclaiming Jesus. They're going all over Jerusalem. They're proclaiming the good news in Jerusalem. And they've gathered quite the following, all right? You know, the religious leaders, they come and they say, we've got to stop these guys. We can't have them spreading this news about Jesus. It's kind of ironic, don't you think? And they have these two arrested, and they take them to jail to shut them up. They want them to stop talking about Jesus. But now they've got a problem. There's about 5,000 men who have gathered together, and they've responded to their teaching. And I would assume if you look at it in the scripture, it paints the picture that they're waiting outside to hear more. All right? So they're inside telling Peter and John, you need to stop preaching about this Jesus guy. And this is what they come to realize. Acts 4:13. When they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized that they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished and they took note that these men had been with Jesus. But since they could see the man who had been healed standing there with them, there was nothing they could say. The proof was right there in the room with them. This is real. So they ordered them to withdraw from the Sanhedrin and they conferred together. So they realized that these ordinary men have been given this extraordinary power. And they can clearly see the evidence of that. They realize that they have to let these guys go because there's evidence of the truth of what they're proclaiming. So as a last resort, they threaten them one more time. You know, they said, do not speak in the name of Jesus again. And this is their response. You've got to love this. But Peter and John replied, which is right in God's eyes, to listen to you or to him? You be the judges. As for us, we cannot help speaking about what we have seen and heard. After further threats, they let them go. And you know, and I love that because when we were excited about something, we're pumped up about something, it takes a lot to shut you up, doesn't it? You know, you'll go and tell anybody who will listen. But for some reason, that doesn't transfer when it comes to the gospel. I got a question for you. I really want you to think about this. Right now, today, at this very moment, if it became a crime to be a Christian, and they came in here and they arrested everybody in this room, every single one of us, and because they suspected you of being a Christian, and they went to your friends and your family and your acquaintances and they asked them, what evidence is there in your life that you are a Christian? And then, since we're pretending here, they went to your home, they went through your computer, and they went through your phone, and they went through everything in your house, looking for evidence. My question is this. Would they find enough evidence? Would they find enough evidence in your life today, right now, to convict you for the crime of being a Christian? You know, this isn't in the sermon notes, but, you know, I asked my daughter, my youngest, this question the other day. You know, and I mentioned earlier that, you know, becoming a parent, having kids, and the agony of becoming a parent can lead to some of the proudest moments of your life. You know, she never ceases to amaze me. You know, we're sitting there at the kitchen table, and I'm making fun of her, and she's making fun of me, and that's just kind of how we talk. And then all of a sudden, I say, Brianna, let me ask you a question. Okay, she knows I got a serious question for her. So I asked her the same question. I said, if it became a crime to be a Christian, and they came in his house right now and they arrested you, you know, and they went and they talked to all your friends, and they went upstairs and they went through your room and they went through your phone, everything, would they have enough evidence to arrest you? She thought about it and she says, I think they would. I think that, you know, all my friends go to church. We talk about God all the time. You know, and then she says, if you go up to my room or look on my phone, you know, she's like, I got my Bible on my phone. I got all my Bible plans on my phone. You know, she said, if you go to my room, you're going to see all my Christian t-shirts. You know, so yeah, I think I would be arrested. I said, good, me too. What about you? What about you? The second thing is we should be unashamed of the might of the gospel. And the verse continues. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God. Except for Jesus Christ himself, nothing else in all the Bible is ever described as the power of God. In light of heaven itself, the power of God in its highest and greatest intensity is found inside the gospel. That word power would have caught the attentions of the Romans. One thing that Rome understood, especially Nero, was power. At that time, the Roman Empire, again, was the only superpower in the world. Yet, Paul was willing to go into the belly of the beast. He was willing to walk into the highest echelons of the greatest power known in the world to say, you may have the power to conquer people, and you may have the power to enslave people, but only the gospel has the power to change people. You inspire people out of fear. God inspires people out of love. Love ultimately is more powerful than fear. 1 John 4:16 says, God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in them. This is how love is made complete among us, so that we will have confidence on the day of judgment. In this world, we are like Jesus. Now pay attention to this part. There is no fear in love. But perfect love drives out fear. Because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. We love because he first loved us. You see, going back to Paul, Peter, John, and anyone else who suffered for their faith, and there were many, they understood something that those in power today, I'm not sure they're capable of understanding this. And that is that true love will overcome anything. True love for you is all Jesus had left. It's what drove him to carry on when he had no strength. It was him thinking of you that kept him going to finish the mission that God had sent him to do. It was our sin that nailed him there, but it was also you that kept him there. That is love conquering fear. Love is the only thing that has the power to bring healing where there is hurt, heaven where there is hell, happiness where there is heartache, peace where there is perplexity, joy where there is judgment, mercy where there is misery, and grace where there is guilt. No other religion in the world has that message. They're all the same, you know. They'll tell you what you have to do, what you have to accomplish, and where you have to go, you know. And then in the end, they'll tell you that it's up to you to get there. You know, it's up to you to make it. It's up to you to accomplish whatever it is they say you need to accomplish. Only the gospel has the power of God to do with us what needs to be done. The church is not the power of God. Religion is not the power of God. Work is not the power of God. Only the gospel is the power of God. What is this power that separates the power of the Christian faith apart from any other religion? The gospel is not good advice on what we have to do to obtain salvation. It's God's power that enables us to just receive salvation. Billy Graham said this, I would not cross the street to talk to somebody about religion, but I will cross the world to talk to somebody about the gospel. We should be unashamed of the might of the gospel. Third, we should be unashamed of the ministry of the gospel. Paul goes on to say, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God that brings salvation. Nobody who has ever lived has had the same problem. I mean, we're all messed up. We are people that lived in a jacked up world. We've all had past mistakes. We all live with failures in the present. We all face the uncertainty of the future. Everywhere you look is guilt, grief, and gloom. We're like somebody who's getting ready to walk out in the desert with nothing but the clothes on our back because we believe salvation is out there. We just need to find it.